Welcome to Revolve, where we explore big questions from all angles. Each season, we use one big question to dive into a topic with experts, showing how perspective matters in building thoughtful solutions. I'm Tripp Williams. Season 1. What makes an economy strong and vibrant? Using Seattle as a case study, this season we talk with different people involved in economic development to learn how economies are built. This episode features Andrew Lewis, a Seattle City Council member representing District 7. The Seattle City Council is a 9-person body that sets policy for the City of Seattle. As Seattle's guiding legislative body and working alongside the mayor, council work covers all topics touching Seattle and its citizens, including economic development. In this episode, Andrew and I explore why a strong middle class is key to economic health, why climate change needs to be considered in any economic development effort, and why the COVID-19 pandemic makes efforts to reduce the population of those experiencing homelessness more important than ever. Thanks for joining. We're excited to have Andrew Lewis, a sitting city council member of the City of Seattle. Andrew, welcome.
Hey, good to be here, Tripp.
So we're excited to run a number of questions by you today, Andrew, to talk about economic development. The first thing I'd like to start with, economic development as a concept and a topic, it means a lot of things to a lot of different people. I'd love to hear from you, from where you sit and in your experience, what economic development means to you.
Right. Well, you know, in the context of a city, a major metropolitan city like Seattle, I think that economic development is really critical because, like any municipal government, you know, we draw strength from our tax base, and the source of a tax base is if you can have a diversified, robust, and broad-ranging local economy that draws from a lot of different sectors. And I think Seattle's a really good example because we have obviously, most famously, internationally, a very robust and strong technology sector here, represented by Microsoft, represented by Amazon as sort of homegrown technology giants. We also have a growing footprint of like Silicon Valley-based tech giants that are coming up here and establishing themselves, like Google, Facebook have a big presence in the city of Seattle. We also have a really strong maritime industrial sector that is the real cornerstone of the Seattle economy, even to this day. I mean, just billions of dollars in economic activity is linked to the Alaska fishing fleet that is based at Fisherman's Terminal. Cargo traffic that comes in through Pacific trade. And as the center of the world has sort of shifted from kind of the post-war European specific sort of orientation of the world to now the more the pivot to Asia, both militarily, economically, and politically. Seattle has definitely benefited from that because it's diversified our economy to also include, to include trade, to include being a more important city as a Pacific port city, since that is where the growing center of global commerce and activity is. So, making sure that as city officials, you are constantly planning to attract, retain, and develop economic hubs in a variety of different industries to provide maximum long-term opportunity and diversified, a diversified tax base. And then also pursuing things, I want to add, there's always all this conversation in the economy about companies creating jobs and the big job creating companies, and that school of thought it does not take into account that before you even get to the point where a company is in a position to quote unquote provide jobs or create jobs or be a mm-hmm. job creator, mm-hmm. It is reflective of the fact that you have a strong middle class and consumer class that can provide the demand to patronize those businesses to, here in Seattle, right? You know, people don't get a Prime account for free, in the context of Amazon, right? You have to have money, you have to pay, for that account. And it's really the middle class, the consumer class that is creating the jobs. You know, Amazon is successful and able to create jobs because of the American consumer class and middle class. And any economy that wants to grow and expand needs to account for strengthening, protecting, and expanding their middle class first, foremost, and always as the most essential investment to maintain long-term growth. So, and cities have a role in that, right? I mean, like $15 minimum wage in Seattle, was a very pro-business measure because it gave more disposable income and more earning power to folks who could in turn turn around, take the additional money they're earning through a higher wage floor, spend that money on things, and then drive more demand for more growth and greater economic expansion. So, any proposal that puts money in the hands of working and middle class people is a pro-growth plan that helps over the long term develop, expand, and build up an economy.
Well, I want to get back to some of the things that, and you alluded to some of those policy mechanisms that you might be able to activate as a local government official. I'd love to get back to that. The first thing I want to ask before we move on is, in your experience, again, the projects that you've seen go particularly well, or on the other side, those that have not gone well, are there common characteristics in economic development projects that succeed or fail?
It is important to make sure that in my experience, I don't have a lot of direct experience personally, like in economic development projects, but from just what I've seen as a city council member, when you're the government, right? I mean, you got to be very cognizant of what your role is in the economy because, the government is not in a position where, we should per se be picking winners and losers. Like the market will pick winners and losers. Mm-hmm. But what we can do is we can be in a position to set up our people to take advantage of a booming economy in a more equitable way and set up our economy to set up the people in our economy to have the resources to drive that demand. Sure. So just to put in, like, I think any policy that is focused on the development of human equity and the development of, enhancing the material security and well-being of working people is going to be very administrable and pay dividends over time. So, I brought up earlier, $15 minimum wage, simple concept. You raise the wage floor, that goes into the marketplace. The marketplace responds to those new regulations, and you have a stronger consumer class, and then that results in more growth over the long term. That's a good example of an administrable program that is kind of set up to work and set up to pay off. Whereas, if you have a project, for example, let's say, a tax break, I think is a good example, right? Like there could be an argument that's made and people that are advocates of trickle down economic strategies will say, you do a tax break, that company is going to take that tax break. They're going to invest that tax break into expanding, right? To provide more goods, more services, and then ultimately more jobs, so that the benefit of that tax break will trickle down and result in that company, creating more growth. Well, there hasn't been a lot of compelling evidence that unless that tax break is a transaction rather than a gift, that you're going to get that kind of a result. We would have had, better luck taking that money and putting it into things that are going to help strengthen consumers and get consumers to spend their money. Because in a lot of cases, a company might do a stock buyback. They might just, share that money with their shareholders via a dividend. And, not everybody owns stocks and certainly doesn't own them to the level where, they're making a massive income off of those dividends. Whereas if you took that money and you put it into, let's say, rent subsidy, right? Like Seattle and a lot of other markets are places where affordable housing is, you know, housing is extremely expensive. And, you know, you want to be in a position where, you know, work people can live closer to work. You know, they can aspire to having more security in their in where they live and not be rent burdened. Mm-hmm. So that because everything that they're putting into rent, that's money that they're not going out in the economy spending on other things and driving demand. So you want to make sure that you have policies in place to look at how government can be an actor to reduce some of the cost of living that kind of falls under our regulatory and police powers as a city. Housing is one of those things for a city. Mm. So, you know, if I had to make a choice, right, as an elected official between, you know, a tax break for a company to try to spur economic growth or take the same amount of money, because we, you know, we got to remember tax cuts cost money regardless of how some people characterize them. And if we're going to make a decision, you know, about where to send that money to spur economic growth, like I would much rather take that money, put it into some kind of rent subsidy so that, you know, renters who are working are in a position where, you know, their rent gets reduced and they can in turn turn around, take that money and spend that money in the economy to drive growth, drive demand and, you know, and increase jobs. That's a better use of that money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, capital flows, as I'm hearing you describe it, is really what makes an economy tick, right? It's much more helpful to have that capital flowing through than kept in accounts and just expanding balance sheets.
Yeah, just one more thing, because I want to get to more questions, but I think that comment about capital flow is really prescient too right now, because, you know, just for the record of this as a sort of historic document, this podcast, you know, we're having this conversation in the middle of, you know, a public health crisis that is evolving into the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And it really has been a symbol of how and, you know, my personal bank account can attest to this, because I've been inside, I've been socially distancing. You know, I've never had like more money handy in like my bank account, because I am not out. You know, I mean, and, you know, we're doing this over the phone, not in person. But if you can see, I got very long hair right now. I haven't been getting haircuts. You know, I haven't been, I haven't been going out to bars for happy hour. I haven't been eating out in restaurants. And the result of that is all of that consumption that was in the economy before, under normal circumstances, all of that money is sitting in people's bank accounts. And, you know, we have so many businesses that are marginal and that like depend that, you know, they can't just shut down for, you know, they can't just kind of say, okay, well, we'll ride this out for, you know, for like half a year, you know, 8 months, however long this is going to end up going. And, it really just shows how critical that, that capital flow, as we've been discussing it, is to maintaining growth. And that we're going to have a lot of firms, a lot of small businesses and a lot of companies that despite our best efforts, you know, they're not going to survive the, this crunch and not being able to get money in the door, barring, some bigger efforts to have some kind of stimulus that can stand in for all of that money that's just sitting in all of our bank accounts that ordinarily would be circulating in the economy. So, it's a tough situation out there. And I think economists will study this, this moment and draw some conclusions about, how much damage gets caused just from shutting an economy off, for a while. So,
And I think on top of, one last, comment there is it's not just the volume of outflows that might come on a even regular cadence, let's say a quarterly basis. It's the economy really requires the regular daily flow, right? Of even smaller numbers of transactions and even smaller, the actual amount in each transaction might be smaller, but it's that constant required trickle that, not to confuse a trickle down economics, but it's the constant flow of capital, not necessarily a volume of capital that's dispensed on a specific cadence, right? It's that.
Yeah.
It's happening. Yeah. Well, today. This really makes the economy thrive.
Well, and that's a really good point. And, you know, the only thing I would add to that too is, you know, we had a debate recently, that, you know, there was some news about it, that was a, you know, because I think that what you're speaking to too is it's really made us see from the standpoint of a city, the effect of like pipeline issues in interrupting some of those cadences. Because, you know, a big function of government, we have a lot of things that we, you know, for a lot of reasons, for the health and safety of the public, there's certain regulations, right? And one of those for land use is design review. Like, you want to put up a new building, you know, you have to engage, you know, with the city, with your neighbors. You go through a design review process as a developer. And those are done through in-person neighborhood meetings. Well, you know, we had this discussion as a council because those groups could not meet in person anymore. It was difficult to do those meetings remotely because of the technical nature of design review.
Sure.
So we, you know, temporarily had to transfer that over to an administrative process to avoid the bottlenecks. And, you know, we did that as we voted on that as a city council to avoid the economic ramifications of disrupting that flow. Because you, you know, these design review boards, some of them here, maybe 30 projects every month. And if all of a sudden, you know, they can't hear any of those projects, and they just, you know, but those projects keep coming. So whenever sure. whenever they did come back to do those design review processes, you know, be it in, you know, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, however long it's going to take, you know, they would have come back and just been overwhelmed, and the backlog would have been massive. And then the effect on the economy, you know, too, in terms of the multiplier of those projects, because if you're building a building, right, you're getting cement, you're getting steel, you're hiring laborers, and like those backlogs in design review, you can see just the tumble sure. that goes back in how it has massive disruption all the way through those supply chains and those different processes that are dependent on you know, people getting their design review done, getting their master use permit, and building their building. So this whole thing has been a really interesting you know, I mean, interesting would be the right word if the effects were not so human and so terrifying in just how, you know, that other element of government, that we have certain regulatory practices that, you know, that are necessary for certain segments of the economy to continue to move. And that when those get put on hold, the broader economic impacts that those have, that, you know, it's another interesting comment on growth.
Yeah. Well, so, and that's actually a great segue. You're really helpfully outlining how local government, one of the primary things you're able to do is clear the way, right, for private enterprise and others to act in the economy. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about, and you also mentioned earlier some of the different regulatory areas and specialties that you as a local government official focus on. But tell us a little bit more about you know, what you see local government doing especially well, in particular in relation to other levels of government, and, you know, and some of the things that you see as nearest at hand and most helpful to keep economies thriving.
Right. I mean, I think that the most important thing is that to kind of jump off my previous comments about the design review, there are certain competencies that are the exclusive purview of local governments. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a bit of what we deal with in our daily lives. And, you know, it depends on where you are, but for the most part in the United States, you know, you're like our local governments actually look, you know, pretty similar in terms of the different competencies they take on, you know, depending on where you live. You know, it might be a city, it might be a county, right? Like, you know, so a major metropolitan city like Seattle, you know, we do tons of the direct services to the people of Seattle. Mm-hmm. And like King County does some, but does less. Whereas if you're, you know, if you're in a rural community, like your county is probably going to do most of the services just because, you know, the reduced density and the city probably less so. Mm. But it, like, so I just putting out that context, sure. but the typical things that kind of fall in, I'll say, is like county city sort of functions, you know, land use, which you already talked about, and you know, the the economy of real estate, of building, of construction, is a massive, massive segment of the growth in the United States over the last 20 years. And in a city like Seattle, it has definitely juiced our massive, the massive boom that we've seen. Like the budget of the city of Seattle, soared from, something like $4 billion to $6.5 billion over the course of a decade, which is huge growth in the budget. Something that is going to lead to difficult conversations going into this downturn, because our budget is going to take a massive hit after spending so much time growing and probably have painful conversations about cuts. But land use is a huge segment of, if cities have more permissive land use practices, can build faster, can build quicker. That has a massive multiplier effect on growth, right? Mm-hmm. So that's an essential competency of local government that has huge economic implications. Typically, also local government, be it a city or a county, is going to provide a lot of the services that people on a daily basis really rely on. I mean, like 90% of the government that people encounter is something that their city or their county does. I mean, like you run into the police is always going to be a city or a county function. Mm-hmm. Fire department, buses, right? Like, mm-hmm. Public transportation generally, subways, buses, things that we interact with on a daily basis. Those are all, the maintenance of public right-of-ways, the streets, the sidewalks that we walk on, all local government, all have a massive, massive implications for economic growth. Because cities that have robust and well-maintained infrastructure are going to be far more competitive to attract people that want to live and work in that place. And the more attractive you are, the more tax base you can attract to your municipality. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really sort of growth can beget growth if you put it back into things like that. And then also, depending on where you are, I mean, it's not the case in the city of Seattle, but I would say education, right, is huge. If you are making the right interconnected investments in education in your city to link your economic development and workforce development initiatives, right, mm-hmm. with your education initiatives, you can become extremely competitive as a city or municipality because you can create these pipelines of making sure that the economic needs of the different clusters that have been developed. I mean, and in our case in Seattle, that would that would basically be like tech, maritime, industrial economy. One thing I continue to be really interested in is, because we do not run the school district, it's a separate government, but we definitely do collaborate with them on a regular basis. How can we be more effective and better collaborators with the school district so we are hooking up, our initiatives to develop our workforce along with, what we are prioritizing and how we are educating the young people of the city. So that when people, are coming out of their primary education or one thing I think that is going to have really great long-term growth prospects for our city is, we recently under Mayor Durkin, adopted a universal community college. And sure. I think that is going to have a really big impact in the long term because we are going to be in a position to provide that extra level of specialized education that could be, like a certificate, it could be an associate's degree, that will just be part of our social contract here in the city of Seattle, where we building on our previous success, where we know, early learning is the best place to put those investments, even more than community college. But we already did that under previous mayoral administrations, made that really big investment in pre-K subsidies. So if you can develop an education system as a municipality that that says our social contract is going to be the city will provide you an education that is going to be a 16-year education in terms of, you know, two years of pre-K and then 2 years of college in addition to the 12 years of primary education, that makes you immensely competitive globally, especially if on the back end those 2 years of college are directly hooked up to some opportunities that are in your local economy. I think is something I really want to do a deeper dive in, and I think it's something that that could really, in the long term, pay massive dividends for the human equity of our city and the future of Seattle.
Sure. And are there places that you, as you look to maybe municipalities or counties that are doing this effectively, are there examples? And I guess this is a really good example of connecting education to job prospects. Taking that example, or if there's another, you know, innovative economic development regime in some city across the country, is there anything you've been drawn to and are seeing as really compelling and really interested in?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. You know, there's lots of interesting, innovative things that, that come up if you read, there's like all these, like Governing Magazine is an example. There's all these kind of niche, like periodicals and publications that kind of talk about interesting stuff that's going on. There is the big thing that comes to mind, I mean, going internationally, for a second, the fact that, and we haven't even discussed climate change yet and kind of the implications of, you know, needing to address climate change to maintain, future economic viability, given the catastrophic impact that climate change unaddressed is going to have on all of us. Mm-hmm. It's been described by a friend of mine recently who's very involved in climate policy as like, imagine we're in a nuclear war, but it's slow. Mm. Right. And like, you know, having the impacts of, you know, like a nuclear war that would happen, you know, really suddenly, right? Within 20 minutes, you know, completely irreversible destruction. But, you know, similar impact over the course of, some people are saying as short as 10 years. And, you know, I think we should take those warnings super seriously, to getting the similar and completely irreversible impacts. When you think about the sense of urgency in those terms, Copenhagen, great example of a city that has been making really great strides towards becoming carbon neutral, and really realizing that cities have a big role in climate. And I think that in the United States, we have a tendency to think of the climate fight as sort of a problem that rural people have, right? Like, you know, coal burning economies, coal dependent states. Less dense communities that, you know, they're more dependent on driving than public transportation. And like, definitely, you know, completely stipulate to the fact that that's part of it. But we got to recognize that, you know, cities have a role in terms of, we have some of the biggest buildings, and big buildings require a lot of heat. And, you know, if our insulation is inefficient and the heat source is coming from some of those rural energy markets, we are burning those rural fossil fuels that we look down our noses at much to power our big buildings. And the result of that, that is having a massive climate impact that we have a role as a city to address. And, you know, it is an urban problem. Copenhagen has been doing a great job in serving as an example as a jurisdiction that is really taking it on as a city and showing that, you know, if more jurisdictions, because it's true, you know, Copenhagen just doing it on its own, that's not going to get us there on global climate change. But if other municipalities around the world, you know, study what Copenhagen is doing and emulate it, and you get, you know, you get 50, 100, you know, 300 municipalities that are modeling that same thing, that is going to start to make an impact and move the needle. Mm-hmm. So looking at things like that and figuring out how we can do things that have global impacts as cities, I think is important. I think also, another initiative I'm working on right now, I'm chairing a committee for the city council on performance auditing to come up with some recommendations and suggestions on how to enhance, protect, and expand our ability to do performance audits and make sure that we are implementing, performance auditing. We don't need to go into a rabbit hole on this, but performance auditing is about measuring efficacy, like is a project effective rather than or a service effective rather than is a service efficient. Mm-hmm. Through that process, been looking at lots of cities and there's a lot of variety in how cities do their internal auditing and performance auditing is something that all municipalities to a certain degree do. It's been really interesting to go through that process, look at some of these other jurisdictions and just see the wide variety in different practices and how, some cities like our neighbor to the south, Portland, Oregon. And I think Portland is a good model in a lot of these things, be it, how to have sustainable, dense and attractive land use and mm-hmm. environmental policies. And then also how to do performance auditing. Portland, basically every 5 years or so, every department's been looked at and they've had substantive feedback and recommendations that enhance the delivery and performance of their services. So, I think Portland has been a really interesting jurisdiction in terms of livability, sustainability, and delivery of essential services. I think it's really important that, we always be talking as cities and, looking at ways that we can come together to learn from each other. And there's definitely things Seattle is doing around.
I was going to say climate change, especially. Yeah. Seattle has a pledge, I think, by 2050, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Well, we've set a goal. We still have a lot to do to set up some things to get there. And I've definitely got some ideas that we can talk about later. I don't think they're ready for this podcast. But but I'll give you the scoop on it when we're ready. This podcast will be the first place we announce it. But I was going to say that the law enforcement assisted diversion program is something that was pioneered here as a creative new way to divert low level drug offenders into treatment, counseling, wraparound services as an alternative to the traditional criminal justice response. It's something that's been emulated all over the world and. There's been, lots of very favorable press, mm-hmm. in the New York Times and other. So there's things that we do really well, too, in Seattle. And, I always look forward to having those conversations with people to have that exchange of here's what we really do well. What do you really do well? And how can we learn from each other? I think is absolutely a critical way. For us to do business as local governments, especially as it comes to figuring out new strategies for growth and economic development.
Yeah. And I want to move to our next question. But for the audience, interestingly, Park City, Utah, I think has a near-term goal of reaching carbon zero levels by, I think, within this decade. So that's a topic I'm hoping to come back to on the podcast, and I'll put that off to the side for now, but I thought it worth mentioning and for people to check out. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's great.
So our next question, Andrew, I'd love to spend multiple hours talking about the work you're involved in and your projects that you're leading. Because of your schedule and mine, I'm going to try to compress that into a few minutes here.
Sure.
But as you mentioned earlier, we're recording this in the midst of COVID-19. There is tremendous economic upheaval across many sectors of the economy and many different parts of the population. One of those populations that's particularly vulnerable and is affected significantly is the homelessness population or those experiencing homelessness, right? And I know you spent a significant amount of time and lead an effort to address that challenge. I'd love for you to both share with us a little bit about that project and your work there and also how you see that population, the homelessness population, especially affected during economically and otherwise during the downturn?
Yeah. So that's a really, really good question. And that's been a big focus of my committee. I chair the Select Committee on Homelessness Strategies and Investments. And You know, we going into this crisis, the thing that is the most sobering and the thing I'm not looking forward to is, you know, we had a debilitating and actually still active state of emergency. We've been in a state of emergency on homelessness in Seattle for over five, for almost 6 years, I think, five mm-hmm. years. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's been extremely debilitating and it's been extremely sad to walk around the city and see that we just have a profound number of our neighbors living in absolute unacceptable squalor mm-hmm. For a society that is as wealthy and as innovative as Seattle is. And, you know, that was all existing pre-COVID. Now we're going to be in a position where we're going to have a massive revenue shortfall. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a conversation as a city about, you know, how do we keep essential services going that, you know, that we were taking for granted before this crisis, let alone how do we do the additional things that we need to do to get our homeless neighbors inside. So, you know, I would just say this. You know, I think that any economic growth strategy has to be focused on human equity writ large. It is not good for your economy to have a massive number of folks that are experiencing homelessness in your city. I mean, it just doesn't put a good foot forward. There are also things you can do to reduce inequality and to reduce cost of living that can crack down on the number of people who are experiencing homelessness through economic necessity. And, you know, I want to be clear, you know, in King County, we have a little over 11,000 individuals that are experiencing homelessness. Many of those folks, you know, one of the contributing factors to being homeless is that they have a public health challenge, mm-hmm. be it, you know, a behavioral mental health diagnosis that is untreated, or substance dependency, or both. And you know, those folks are going to require a more service intensive response, you know, permanent supportive housing, wraparound services, something where we can get them inside, and they can live with dignity. But you know, they're not going to be part of like a workforce development program, for example. Mm-hmm. Then we have, you know, the folks that are homeless for economic reasons, who are car camping, maybe living in encampments and working in minimum wage jobs. You know, these are folks that are working, they are making money, and they are making an economic decision to, at least for now, live homeless because they don't have the resources to be able to save, to be able to get ahead by also paying exuberant rents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our role in that is going forward, I want to do a couple things. First, we got to scale up permanent supportive housing. We got to make it easier to build. We've got to get people who are, you know, chronically homeless because of a health condition. We got to get them inside, off the streets, with wraparound services so they can live with dignity and they're not exposed and living in squalor. Mm-hmm. That's, number one, we need to do that. Second thing we need to do is we need to have big city initiatives to invest in rent subsidy so that those folks that are working, like the working poor in the city of Seattle, can get some kind of assistance and relief and subsidy so that they can rent and live in an apartment in the city in dignity. And continue to work, save, get ahead, and meet their other obligations without being rent burdened. And as I alluded to earlier, that is also a pro-growth strategy because it frees up some of their income to go spend on things that will help drive growth. Mm-hmm. So I think those are the things that we really need to be focused on. We need to dig deep, and we need to find a way to provide the resources to do that in the COVID emergency, despite all of our other pressures. We cannot lose sight of the fact that we had a homelessness crisis before. That homelessness crisis is going to get worse now. It's not going to get better during COVID. We will have more people that were in service sector jobs. I mean, there were the federal government, might have been the Fed or some other body of the federal government said the other day that 40% of low-wage workers lost their jobs so far during the COVID crisis. And, you know, a number of those folks are going to go back to work when the crisis is has abated and, like, the economies are opening up again. And, like, a lot of those folks have received some level of unemployment benefit. But it is still setting them back no matter what. And, and any relief that we are giving is not going to ultimately be enough. And it is not unreasonable to expect that of that 40%, a lot of those folks are going to become economically homeless or transitionally homeless. And they're going to be on top of the massive population of people experiencing homelessness we already had. So we need to be in a position where we are making progress on getting people inside and meeting their needs as part of the recovery. We can't hold off on it and use the crisis as an excuse for inaction on it.
Sure. That's great. And I just want for the audience, if they want to track your efforts on this topic and others, can you just share with them the best places to find you? And I can include this detail in the notes as well, but I just want them to hear it from you.
Yeah, super easy. Seattle.gov/council/Lewis. That's my website. You can sign up there for email updates. You know, I send out on a fairly regular basis, typically at least twice monthly, kind of updates on what my office is up to. People can follow me on Twitter, you know, Lewis for Seattle, at Lewis for Seattle on Twitter. People can email me directly at andrew.lewis@seattle.gov. Always happy to talk about these topics we discussed today and any others, you know, especially for Seattle residents. And, you know, just look forward to continuing to have these conversations with you, Tripp, and others, because, you know, having these conversations about how we grow the economy, how we do it equitably, how we do it in a way that that everybody is benefiting from. These are going to be they were critical conversations during the last recession and recovery. If anything, they're more prescient now, and we need to learn from the mistakes that were made then. And, you know, that could be a subject of a whole additional podcast episode. So anyway,
I have one more for you, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure,
it's going to be a quick one. But and I've offered this to every guest on this season. I have a hint of what your answer might be, knowing what position you hold now. But let's imagine we're going to have an abstract thought experiment here. Let's imagine we're in a scenario where you are leading the effort to build a new extension of a civilization. Let's say we're on the moon, and you're tasked with helping craft a vibrant economy. If we think about the different actors involved in that effort, if we think about government actors, private sector actors, nonprofit actors, which of those hats would you like to put on first? And what would be one of the first things you would do?
Can you maybe rephrase the question? You're asking me which role I personally would want to fill?
Yeah. If you could step into, if knowing what we know about the different components of an economy, which of those, you know, which seat at the table would you like to be holding first, or which lever would you like to pull first?
The only one I feel qualified to kind of answer and say that I would is, you know, obviously, you know, whatever government authority we're setting up. And, you know, I think government occupies a really unique role, you know, in the economy, and that, you know, it's the operator of, you know, of the commons, right? It's everything that we decide, you know, these are essential. There should not be a profit motive in these things that everybody needs. These are the things that we are going to turn over, you know, to, you know, in the case of the United States, to a elected group of fellow citizens for fixed terms, and they will administer the commons, and we will, you know, as citizens, hold them accountable and review their work. I guess that there would, in the scenario that you're sort of laying out, there would probably be a process where, you know, we might have a process where we're evaluating the extent of what our new social contract is going to be, right? Mm. I mean, like, we're in a position right now where, you know, on some things, you know, we have a mixed economy. I mean, like healthcare, right? Great example. You know, a lot of countries have decided healthcare, healthcare is a utility that kind of fits in the same way you know, as police, fire, other things that we would historically put into the commons that would be under, you know, under the government. So I guess that, you know, that would probably be the first step, is we'd have to make some decisions and say, hey, look, you know, we are going to have a conversation here as our moon colony, and we are going to, and you know, and we're gonna decide, you know, I mean, what is gonna be in the commons, what isn't, you know, and what's gonna be in the free market, and how do we want to do that in the first steps of structuring an economy? Because I do think it is an essential conversation, because you know, you want to make sure that you know, you want to make sure that everyone's on the same page of, you know, what is going to be in the purview of government and what isn't, and then go forward accordingly. So
wonderful. Well, that's a fantastic end to a very rich conversation. I really appreciate your time, Andrew, and thanks for joining.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Trip. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for listening. Check the show notes for links and information mentioned in the episode. And explore the other episodes in this season to learn more on this topic. Look, I've listened to them all. I'm obviously a little bit biased, but I really do think each offers a valuable perspective you'll appreciate. Before we go, subscribe to our show to get new episodes as soon as they come online. And please rate us on whatever podcast app you use. That helps other people discover the show as well. We'd be excited to hear from you. Send us a mail at revolvepodcast@gmail.com.